From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because life and truth matter. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we continue an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast that we began on our previous broadcast. Hank is talking with Christian apologist Graham Veal, author of New Atheism, A Survival Guide. Let's pick up Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Graham Veal.
Sometimes I think we've made the Christian faith transactional as opposed to transformational. You know, the idea that you get a quick profession, and after you've made the profession, you get a car that gets you out of hell and gets you into heaven, and now you live as a baptized secular humanist. I mean, if you look at Christians and what they're modeling, are they really modeling a transformational lifestyle, or is this just a transaction that gets me into heaven and I can live just like the culture lives? And when the kids see that, they think, look, there's no difference between the culture. It's maybe a little bit more prudish and backwards, but there's no real big difference between the way my parents, my school teachers, my pastor, my youth pastor, there's no real big difference between them and the world after the transaction is all said and done.
Yeah. I mean, part of the difficulty here is that from a middle class, upper middle class parents' point of view, evangelical Christianity can actually seem like a good deal. If you think about it, you know, if your child follows the evangelical Christian lifestyle, they're going to stay away from drink, they're going to stay away from drugs, they're going to, you know, be in less danger of STDs, and there are all sorts of benefits that a teenager might look at and say, well, that's boring, but a parent will look at and say, that's wonderful. And so we go through the process of, they go through the transaction, they, you know, you put your hand up, you do your, you know, you pray your prayer, you pretend you're in, and you can fit into a very comfortable lifestyle, which is very good educationally for a lot of young people. A lot of young people do very well because they're staying away from these negative influences. And at the end of the day, part of the difficulty is that there's no real cost. There's nothing where you're saying to anybody, look, this is going to actually cost you something as you live your life. You know, you know, there's places that you're not going to be allowed to go. Not in the sense of, I'm not suggesting there's some sort of legalistic checklist that we have to go through here. But in the sense of, there are certain forms of entertainment that are not going to be healthy, and you would know they're not healthy, so you're just going to have to, in your own wisdom, say no to those. But it's also going to be much more important. Much more importantly, you're going to have to put charity, love, the greatest virtue, above success. You're not going to be allowed to be a ruthless business person, for example. You know, you're not going to be as ruthless as the next guy. You're just going to have to make a change to who you are as a person. And the world might be having a rat race, and you will be putting yourself at a deliberate disadvantage in that rat race, because you're going to say, no, I'm going to love my enemies. We're not prescribing foolishness here, but what I am saying is that there's a real difference that Christianity should make to the individual character, that if we read the New Testament correctly, it's saying, listen, this is going to cost you when you walk out into the world. And that part of the equation is not discussed. It's brushed under the carpet. And what we're left with is this very nice lifestyle, which is very reassuring to a lot of parents. And yeah, I mean, I'm the father of a teenage boy. And where my son goes in future years, I would love to be able to set out a plan where I could say, you know, yeah, I'll keep him at this church because they've got this sort of entertainment in that place. But the problem is, how could you ever know that faith was real? And if you don't teach them that, look, you've got a faith, and look, it's going to cost you something, and sometimes it'll cost you friendship groups, because they'll want to go places and do things and be with people and have life goals that you can't have. And while you might really want to stay in with that friendship group, and while you might even love them as friends, just as time goes on, people do generally drift apart a bit. And it's costly. The Christian life can be costly, and we don't really explain that to our young people. And I think J.C. Ryle said, whenever you need to preach the cross, the cost. But whenever you talk about the cost, then you can talk about the rewards as well. But you do need to do both. And in this book on holiness, he's very clear that you need to do both. Talk about the cost, and yes, then immediately go on and talk about, yes, but why that is worth it. This isn't the cost that you pay to somehow earn your salvation. Salvation's a free gift. But yes, you're called to lift up your cross then and follow him. But that's worth it. And here's why. And these are all things that we need to be saying. We need to preach the whole message honestly. But if we just offer our young people a lifestyle, the first danger is that we will lose a lot of our young people. The second danger is that we will frustrate a lot of Christian young people who are looking for something deeper. But the greatest danger is that a lot of people will buy into that lifestyle and nothing else. And we just perpetuate a social club. That's the danger. And I think every denomination and every part of God's church will face those sorts of challenges. But I do worry somewhat that we can end up with churches that could go on going through the motions for generation after generation, and how many people have just bought into something which is comfortable and culturally reassuring instead of what's really at the heart of Christianity. That's the difficulty.
And I think, too, to some degree, a lot of churches have bought into sort of a defeatist mentality. We're living at the end of the age, Christ is going to come back at any moment, and therefore we've kind of lost the culture wars, but we're going to get raptured, and whatever else happens, we don't have to worry about. And so this defeatist mentality really belies the Christian ethic, that one word of truth, as Solzhenitsyn put it, can outweigh the entire world. That one person, the power of one person can make a difference. We can have a Daniel moment. We can have a Lydia moment. There are epic swings in human history, and we can't give in to the defeatist mentality because of what we see around us. I mean, I heard a pastor say the other day, look, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that Christ is going to come back at any moment, because all you have to do is look at the newspaper. It's obvious. And if you have that kind of a mentality, then I don't think that you are marked out for transforming culture, which we're called to do.
That's right. That's right. And I think the other get-out-of-jail-free card that we cling to here in Northern Ireland, I would imagine it would be the same in some parts of the United States, is revival. It's okay, God will send revival. The words of the hymn here, send a revival, Lord, start the work in me. People aren't so keen on that second part. But the idea is that God will do something that will get us out of this, and it'll either be a rapture or a revival. The difficulty with saying is this is obviously the end times, is that, yes, I mean, Christianity may be taking a cultural hammering in the West. But if you look at the church in other parts of the world, there's tremendous signs for hope. And people in those parts of the world might be saying, listen, we've got a harvest to bring in here. So, don't be so quick to assume that the entire church is to be viewed through Western lenses. So that's something that people need to keep in mind. But, there's Luther's famous saying that if he's told that Christ was coming back tomorrow, he'd plant an apple tree today, which is something that I mull over in my head from time to time. If you have met somebody who has been brutalized or who has had a horrendous childhood or life through cruelty or neglect or abuse, you will be absolutely astonished to find how much meaning they find in the simple acts of kindness that they have experienced in their life from different people and how much that's meant to them. And one thing that I try to get through to people is never underestimate the power of a simple act of kindness. Now, how many times do you multiply that out when you're taking a message of God's kindness, Christ's kindness, God the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, their kindness and love? How much more do you multiply out the comfort and the joy that that can bring to somebody who's broken. So for the church just to sit back and to say, well, you know, we're just going to ride this out to the second coming, it's actually an act of extraordinary cruelty, never mind faithlessness to our master. Because there are people out there who need that word. Now, again, I speak as a man, I speak as a human being. I believe that that God has plans and his providence that we know little about. And I'm not suggesting that, you know, that this God's plan relies on my effort. But we have to remember his challenge to Ezekiel. You know, if people don't hear the word because you do nothing, I'm going to treat it like it's your fault. I mean, there is a responsibility placed on us here. And for us not to carry the gospel out to the broken person in front of us, the broken person that we meet, the neighbour that we meet on the road, on the way in our lives, is an act of extraordinary cruelty almost. Because there are people out there who desperately need the life and love that God can bring. And there's a world out there that desperately needs the truth that we have to bring. And yes, as you transform lives, you automatically transform culture. And you have to put some thought into that. You can't just assume that it's all going to fall into place. There has to be wisdom here. But yes, we need to be reaching out to people around us. We need to be reaching out, you know, with the message of God's word. And not in the sense of, you know, pray this prayer after me and then I'm just going to move on because that's you saved. We're fine, we're done with you. Attend church once a week. And, you know, there needs to be a continual building up and comforting and supporting people throughout their Christian life that we need to really labour very hard on. Very, very, very hard. You know, Paul talks about, you know, our faith inspired by hope and our labour prompted by love. We need to have a labour that will just continually go on where we might not be able, say the culture wars are over and they're lost. Assume, I don't think they are, but suppose that's them gone. That does not mean that God's working for his people has in any way stopped. You continue to reach out and you continue to preach and you continue to challenge falsehood because those falsehoods are cruel and they will break people. And they will splinter their lives into pieces, and they need to be challenged. We need to challenge falsehood when we find it, and we need to challenge the culture around us. And if God sends a time of healing for the culture and the tide changes, you know, that's in God's plan, but we need to labour on because that's what God calls us to do. And there are people who are desperately broken, desperately lost, or desperately blind, or all three. And they need what Christ has done for them, and they need it explained to them persuasively, and they need it offered to them rationally, and they need it offered to them by somebody who cares for them genuinely, genuinely knows them, genuinely cares for them, and will be there for them come what may.
You know, when I listen to the passion in your voice as you're explicating this, it reminds me of the fact that you have a particular interest in the moral argument for God, and that's very much related to what you're talking about.
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, I mean, the idea that morality can, in any sense, be explained without God, particularly from the point of view of the atheism, I actually find that very implausible. I think that the real issue here comes down to how can morality be first of all, how can we trust our moral intuitions at all if our brains have been assembled by natural selection, if our brains have been assembled by some sort of random process? Why trust any of our moral intuitions? Now, even Dawkins in The God Delusions calls morality a blessed, precious mistake. Now, the interesting thing there is that he's saying that basically natural selection has primed our brains to be compassionate because if you're a compassionate person, it displays to a potential mate that you've got a lot of resources, that you are somebody who can offer a potential mate a lot in terms of the riches that you have. But also there's a bit of tit-for-tat going on. You scratch my back, I scratch yours. So there's all these things, he says, that are going on in evolution by natural selection that have really created this thing called morality, which isn't terribly efficient. It's not a terribly efficient thing. It does lead people to do things like to lay down their lives for strangers or even for their enemies. And it does, but in that sense, it's a mistake. But he calls it a precious mistake. Now, if he's going to be consistent, he can't put in that word precious. He can't do that. It's not precious. Unless he just means in the sense of a matter of taste, in the way that somebody, you know, might like fine wine as opposed to good beer, you know, he just happens to like morality. But I don't think he means that, because he continually moralizes people who disagree with him. So he sees morality as something good, but my question is, well, Richard, why would you trust any of your moral intuitions if you see morality as a mistake, as a perspective for the process that created it? You know, why do you value your moral intuitions? Unless somebody has designed us and given us some sense of what's right and wrong, well, you know, unless that's happened, we really shouldn't be trusting our consciences at all.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Graham Veal. Christians today are exposed to relentless attacks on theism by atheists. Graham Veal's book, New Atheism, A Survival Guide, will help you understand atheism and how best to respond to the threat it poses. To receive your copy of New Atheism, A Survival Guide, as our thanks for your gift, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. That's equip.org. We'll return to this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast right after this. Supporting the work of the Christian Research Institute is now as easy as sending a text message. Here's how you can help by texting your gift directly to CRI. To make a one-time gift to help equip fellow believers through the ongoing work of CRI, text TRUTH in all capital letters to 41444. That's TRUTH to 41444. To become a CRI support team member and make a difference on a regular basis, text STANDING in all capital letters to 91999. Again, that is STANDING to 91999. We do what we do here at CRI because life and truth matter. And all of our outreaches are made possible by people like you standing shoulder to shoulder with us to make a difference for now and for eternity. God bless you. Richard Dawkins' grasp of philosophical arguments wouldn't earn him a passing grade in a freshman philosophy course, but he doesn't mean to deal with the questions that theists are asking. He simply ridicules his opponent's position. In New Atheism, A Survival Guide, Graham Veal explains, the new atheist stance is that the reasons for theism must be so bad, why even read about them? My goodness, no, you just dismissed them. Veal goes on to show that the new atheists have not offered one original argument for atheism, but they've plenty of original insults. New Atheism offers an accessible, practical resource for countering new atheist attacks. To receive your copy of New Atheism, A Survival Guide, as our thank you gift, simply call 888-7000-CRI. And make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches or visit equip.org. Of Nancy Piercy's recent book, Love Thy Body, Answering Hard Questions About Life and Sexuality, Professor Robert P. George of Princeton University says, liberal secularist ideology rests on a mistake, and Nancy Piercy puts her finger right on it. In embracing abortion, euthanasia, homosexual conduct and relationships, transgenderism and the like, liberal secularism is philosophically as well as theologically untenable. Piercy is precisely clear about what makes humans valuable. Don't just read, master, love thy body. To receive your hardcover copy as our appreciation for your financial partnership, simply call 888-7000-CRI. And make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-transforming outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. On this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff, we're bringing to you an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast in which Hank talked with Graham Veal, author of New Atheism, A Survival Guide. Duke University philosopher Alex Rosenberg, a devout atheist, bites the bullet in noting that if atheists desire to enjoy life without illusions, they must realize there is no meaning or purpose of life, and there is no moral difference between right and wrong. Tragically, multitudes of college students are drinking deeply from this nihilistic nonsense. Graham Veal's book, New Atheism, A Survival Guide, is an accessible, penetrating, and practical resource for responding to the nihilistic nonsense of atheists. To receive your copy of New Atheism, A Survival Guide, as our thanks for your gift, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Now let's rejoin Hank Hanegraaff and Graham Veal in their conversation.
Why do you value your moral intuitions? Unless somebody has designed us and give us some sense of what's right and wrong, well, you know, unless that's happened, we really shouldn't be trusting our consciences at all. But secondly, why does Richard Dawkins moralize so much? I mean, he honestly believes that there's some sort of moral, but if you get involved, you listen to him, he believes that people ought to agree with him. You know, rationally ought, but also morally ought, because he basically sees religion as dangerous. And therefore, it's something that we need to get rid of because it's morally wrong to bring people up in religious environments. Now, where does that moral ought come from? I mean, why? Yes, there may be all sorts of moral values in there. But, you know, if an artist decides that he wants to leave his wife and go off to Tahiti and paint beautiful paintings there, and he ignores his obligations to his wife and child, we might enjoy the art, but we condemn the artist because there are other goals than his artistic success. There are other goals than beauty. There are moral oughts that outweigh those considerations. So a politician who decides, well, the refugees that are coming into my, you know, are coming into my country, or the country that I want to invade to get their resources, those people, they might, the people that would be hurting me pursuing that policy, they might matter, but my success is a rational consideration too, and we would condemn the politician who puts his personal success over and above the lives of people who he might affect, or if he put his own personal success above the lives of the citizens he was elected to take care of, we would condemn that person. Because there are moral oughts that outweigh self-interest. There are moral oughts that outweigh artistic interest, that outweigh every other sort of interest. But the big question is, why? You know, where does this weight, where does this force come from? Where does obligation come from? And you really can only have obligations to a person. And so to my mind, the best explanation by far here is that morality is really, or that morality is best explained as the commands of God, or the will of God, or God's desire for our life, or something along those lines. We need a lawgiver here if there are going to be moral laws. There needs to be a moral lawgiver. So I think even if you read the New Atheism and you begin to look at their moralizing, there are two big questions there that I think Dawkins needs to answer. Now, there are many, many more, but those are the two I would bring out first and foremost. So, Richard, why would you trust any of your moral intuitions, given that you think that the cognitive device in between your ears that produces those intuitions was sort of assembled without any real design in mind, and certainly not with morality in mind, and that you think morality is inefficient? And given that you think morality is inefficient, why do you find it so powerful? How do you explain the power of morality? Why is it that you pay so much attention to moral obligations? Because they seem to be inescapable. Moral obligations are inescapable. We can't live without them. We can't ignore them. But the difference is this. I can explain moral obligation. I can explain the power of conscience. Richard Dawkins can't. He's got to live by it. He's stuck with it, but he can't explain it. And so to that extent, I think the moral argument for the existence of God is extremely powerful. And it's certainly something that I have found that helped me a lot as a Christian young person with doubts over the years. It's one that I have found very, very useful.
You know, you talk about this near pressure. It almost seems to me, even though we're not supposed to take on this particular motif and sneer at a Dawkins, but when I think about what you have just explicated, I oftentimes think, you know what? A guy like Alex Rosenberg, who wrote The Atheist Guide to Reality, Enjoying Life Without Illusions, is far more upfront and honest with his students. He happens to be a professor of philosophy at Duke University. And he just bites the bullet. He says there's no purpose to the universe. There's no meaning to life. You're here just as a function of dumb luck. There's no such thing as metaphysical realities like souls. There's no such thing as free will. There's no difference between right or wrong, good or bad. He embraces the logical implication of his worldview.
Yes, yes. I think that he's very consistently nihilistic, and I think he's to some extent applauded for that. I think one solution he suggested once for this, you know, how should somebody deal with such a bleak worldview? And I think his line was, "We'll try Prozac."
That's exactly what his line was. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not really livable. I think would be my simple answer to that, and I'm not sure. I mean, I think Francis Schaeffer actually would probably have suggested, well, can you live that way? And I think Francis Schaeffer's approach to that sort of argument is probably the best one. Is, well, that's very easy to say, but can you really live like that? It's a bit like a man saying, here's my view of life, I strongly believe in it, but it's probably mistaken. You can't believe both of those things at the same time. You either believe that this is your worldview or you believe it's probably mistaken. There's a contradiction there. And I would wonder if Alex Rosenberg can really live that way, if he can really consistently maintain those beliefs. I would have thought it would have been nigh on impossible. Given that even sociopaths will acknowledge that there's a moral force that they really ought to feel more strongly about, but don't, I would say that would be a fairly unlivable philosophy. But I do think it's what they're left with. And also, I mean, and obviously my other argument against Alex Rosenberg, his point of view is, well, again, you're saying that the human brain was assembled by a process that was really there that really benefits species that can reproduce and survive and pass on their genes. Now, that process gives us brains that are very good, but from your point of view, should be good at, you know, helping us getting away from predators and that sort of thing. Now, those brains were not designed for science, but I'll tell you what they definitely were not designed for, and that's metaphysics. They definitely were not designed to get at life, the universe, and the meaning of everything. That's not an evolution's wheelhouse at all. So why do you trust your brain to tell you that nihilism's true? Now, he really is on a very sticky wicket, I think, because if he's trying to embrace this scientific worldview where everything is just matter in motion, well, I suppose that's putting it crudely, but if he wants to take that very, very, you know, strong worldview, where mind has absolutely no place at all, and morality has no place at all in that worldview, it's all about the stuff that science can verify, that science can cope with, that would fit sensibly into that sort of materialistic worldview, then if you're going to go down that materialistic line, I really think that you are in big trouble, because you're suggesting your brain was created by a materialistic process that was never designed to let you know if things like materialism were true. You know, you're making a big claim about metaphysical truths, and your brain was in no way prepared to deal with that if you believe evolution by natural selection is the only show in town when it comes to explaining the human brain.
I was just flipping through your book as you were talking, New Atheism, a Survival Guide, and something that I had underlined a long time ago is your statement that Dawkins hypothesizes that chance plus evolution plus billions of opportunities on Earth like planets explains appearance of design in the living world. That hypothesis leads to a prediction. Even if we found trillions of Earth-like planets, the majority would be lifeless. A small fraction would have bacterial life. And we would only find conscious animals on the tiniest fraction. However, suppose we discovered that all of these planets were teeming with creatures like birds and mammals. Dawkins' hypothesis would be falsified. Why?
Right. So what Dawkins wants to say when it comes to the design of life is he talks about Mount Improbable. So on one side of Mount Improbable, you've got to imagine this as a very, very, very steep slope up one side, like a sheer cliff. And you stand at the bottom of Mount Improbable as a climber, and you think, I'm never going to be able to get up to the top of that mountain. But if you would just go round to the other side, you would see a long, gentle slope which you could make your way up with ease. There is a way up to the top of the mountain. Now, Dawkins would then come back round and say, well, if you take a single cell, and you look at a single cell, and at the other end of the spectrum you've got a human being, or a blue whale, or something majestic like that, you would say, well, there's no way that one cell by chance could somehow grow into that human being one day, could evolve into that human being by chance. But if you would just go round to the other side of Mount Improbable, and would look at even evolution by natural selection, you would say, yes, it's a huge leap to get from that one cell all the way up to humans. But it's not such a big leap to get from one cell to a slightly more complex cell, and then a slightly more complex cell yet, and then the multicellular animals. And if you keep moving by small steps, it's very easy to see how we can move with a little bit of luck at each stage all the way up to humans. And there are a number of problems with this argument. The first of all is that while each step involves just a little bit of luck in Dawkins' terms, those probabilities multiply out. So if it's a 90% chance that you will get up each step of Mount Improbable, if you multiply 90% by 90% by 90%, you keep moving along, you get to a very small percentage indeed. But on top of that, there are a number of steps that Dawkins says are extremely improbable. First of all, the origin of life itself. He sees that as a very low probability event. The first eukaryotic cells, he sees that as extremely improbable. And the development of consciousness, he sees that as extremely improbable. Now, at that stage, you're saying, well, hang on, Richard, if there's three very improbable events, how in any sense have you explained why there's conscious living human beings on Earth? Has evolution failed? And he says, no, not at all. There are billions and billions and billions of Earth-like planets out there. A small number of those will have life on them. A smaller number still will have eukaryotic cells. And on a much smaller number, again, you're going to have conscious animals. And I suppose on a much smaller number, you'll have maybe civilizations. So look at natural selection, explain everything according to Richard Dawkins. Now, the first question is, where's your evidence for these worlds? He doesn't have any. We found some more Earth-like planets out there, but that basically means they've got water, or at least they're the right distance from a sunlight star. They've got water. We don't have any confirmation of life anywhere else in the universe. We certainly don't have any independent evidence for Earth-like planets in the sense that Dawkins means, and that's planets which are all capable of supporting a human civilization.
We'll pick up Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Graham Veal in just a few moments. The Bible Answer Man broadcast and CRI's growing array of outreaches have never been more needed than they are today. And that's why we won't be shy in asking you to stand shoulder to shoulder with the Christian Research Institute through your persistent prayers and generous financial support. Stand with Hank Hanegraaff and CRI in the battle for life and truth, and receive your copy of New Atheism, A Survival Guide, as our thanks for your gift. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. We'll be back after this quick break with more of this special edition of the Bible Answer Man. A of Nancy Piercy's recent book, Love Thy Body, Answering Hard Questions About Life and Sexuality, Professor Robert P. George of Princeton University says, liberal secularist ideology rests on a mistake, and Nancy Piercy puts her finger right on it. In embracing abortion, euthanasia, homosexual conduct and relationships, transgenderism and the like, liberal secularism is philosophically as well as theologically untenable. Piercy is precisely clear about what makes humans valuable. Don't just read, master Love Thy Body. To receive your hardcover copy as our appreciation for your financial partnership, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-transforming outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. In The Atheist's Guide to Reality, Enjoying Life Without Illusions, Duke University professor and new atheist philosopher Alex Rosenberg bites the bullet and declares that to be a consistent atheist, you'll have to be comfortable with a certain amount of nihilism and, just in case, there's always Prozac. Because a growing multitude of college students are drinking deeply from this nihilistic nonsense, we shouldn't be surprised that so many of our national spiritual and cultural indicators are headed south. Graham Veal's concise book, New Atheism, A Survival Guide, is an accessible, practical resource for responding to the nihilistic nonsense of New Atheist. To receive your copy of New Atheism, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's mind-changing and life-transforming outreaches. Or visit equip.org. Supporting the work of the Christian Research Institute is now as easy as sending a text message. Here's how you can help by texting your gift directly to CRI. To make a one-time gift to help equip fellow believers through the ongoing work of CRI, text TRUTH in all capital letters to 41444. That's TRUTH to 41444. To become a CRI support team member and make a difference on a regular basis, text STANDING in all capital letters to 91999. Again, that is STANDING to 91999. We do what we do here at CRI because life and truth matter. And all of our outreaches are made possible by people like you standing shoulder to shoulder with us to make a difference for now and for eternity. God bless you. Welcome back to a special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. Richard Dawkins' grasp of philosophical argumentation wouldn't earn him a passing grade in an undergraduate philosophy course. Yet the dumbed-down ridicule he and other atheists wield slides effortlessly past a growing number of college students receptive to such ridiculous rhetoric. Graham Veal's concise book, New Atheism, A Survival Guide, offers an accessible, penetrating, and practical resource for countering atheist attacks. To receive your copy of New Atheism, A Survival Guide, as our thanks for your gift, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. Or visit equip.org. Now let's rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Christian apologist Graham Veal.
We certainly don't have any independent evidence for Earth-like planets in the sense that Dawkins means, and that's planets which are all capable of supporting a human civilization. Because that's what he needs to get this argument to work. He needs billions of Earth-like planets all capable of supporting an Earth-like civilization. So he has no evidence for that. But beyond that, he has actually made a hypothesis. He said that, you know, if we did find these billions of Earth-like planets, he can tell us proportions that, you know, most of them won't have life. Some will have single cells. They will have, you know, prokaryotic cells, smaller number of eukaryotic cells, and a smaller number of conscious animals. And he has made this remarkable prediction, which he has absolutely no evidence for. And my big problem here is that my understanding is that Darwin never offered his theory in the sense of I'm going to explain the existence of complex life on billions and billions and billions of Earth-like planets. He suggested that this was a, you know, he wanted this to be an explanation for life on Earth as we have it now, but he was trying to explain life on one planet, on billions of planets. He would have been astounded at the size of the universe. He had no evidence for that at all. So if you were to go back and say, well, look, your explanation only works if we've got billions and billions and billions of Earth-like planets for this process to take part on, I think the answer would come back as, well, then this explanation really isn't working terribly well at all. There needs to be something more going on here then than just natural selection. We need to look for something beyond that. So I think the design argument is actually alive and well, you know, in the living world. And that works irrespective of your view of origins of species or of humans or whatever, you know. But rather than get into those debates, I would just rather say to people, look, you know, at the end of the day, there's a creator. You're just going to have to acknowledge that. And I think that there's, you know, the evidence for design to me seems to be as powerful as it ever was. And certainly hasn't been challenged in any strong way by the finding of science at all.
That's what I love about the intelligent design movement. I mean, intelligent design theorists are willing to follow the facts wherever they lead. And you have a person like Dawkins. Well, he starts with the presupposition that there cannot be the supernatural, so he has to continue coming up with these far-fetched ideas and then try to pawn them off on an unsuspecting public.
What I find very consistent here is that Dawkins can come up with a very weak argument and yet somehow remain culturally respectable. But if you're in any way attached to the intelligent design movement, you're some sort of pariah. And unfortunately, one aspect of these debates that I find very regrettable is the way that some Christian scientists who maybe aren't attached to the intelligent design movement, maybe because they are from a more, you know, theistic evolutionist point of view, or sometimes from on the more the old-fashioned conservative young Earth creationist point of view, the way that some Christians have begun to speak about each other in this debate has not been helpful. Either questioning people's faith or their intellectual integrity, and you know, I find that quite disheartening. I mean, I know intelligent design is a broad church and brings in more than just Christians. I mean, that has to be said. You don't have to, you know, it's not a Christian movement per se, but there are Christians in there, and they're quite comfortable to designate themselves as Christians. And some of the things that I have read in book reviews and the like, it has got very, you know, it has been unpleasant at times. And you know, there can be a civility within the academy that sometimes, between people who aren't Christians, that sometimes Christians don't obey when they talk about each other. And that has been a bit unfortunate. But again, to go back to your point, when you talk about Richard Dawkins, and you know, he maintains his cultural respectability. But if you're in any way going to mention design, if you're going to allow the divine a foot in through the door, you are going to be a pariah to many people out there in the secular world who just seem to be absolutely terrified of anything that sounds vaguely religious in any sense.
What's interesting, when you look at his books, I mean, they're not really endorsed by historians and philosophers or intellectuals, but more likely by cultural icons.
Yes, and I think that explains an awful lot about the movement. If you look at the dust jacket and you see who endorses it, then you know it gives you an idea. So Darren Brown, who's a magician, I think, endorsed it. Ian McEwan, who's a novelist, wrote Atonement. I mean, we're not talking about historians of science. We're not talking about philosophers of science. I think that it is significant that the new atheism began to rise just as Twitter was getting off the ground. I think that there is a... I think that's more than just a coincidence. I think it maybe speaks to the intellectual culture that we're moving in. I think it speaks to the mindset of many people out there where put-downs and witticisms and insults and style matter so much more than a substantial, well-informed argument and good faith in that argument. You know, somebody making a reasonable point in good faith and in good conscience matters for very little in an age where you have to say something important in 140 characters, or 280 now if you're very important, but 140 characters, not 140 words, 140 characters. That really only leaves you room for insults. That really only leaves you room for shallow invective. But when it comes to just the basic courtesy of listening to what somebody else has to say, it's not there. It's not there. And Christians need to be careful we don't do the same thing. We cannot respond to unbelief by using the same strategy of you know, getting our own stand-up comedians and making our own zingers and making our own wee one-liners. We've got to follow the narrow path. We've got to present the truth faithfully and in love and conscientiously. And if you care for the person you're presenting the truth to, you will try to present them a good argument. You will not try to con them. You will try to show integrity, and you will try to show care and thought in what you're presenting to that person. Yes, you'll make mistakes, and yes, you're not to be afraid of making mistakes, because the person who you're talking to will have patience with you and will allow you those mistakes if they see that you're doing this with integrity and care and with their good in mind. If you try to appear very, very funny and very, very entertaining, you know, the second you make a mistake, if all you wanted to do was entertain, the other person will switch off. So characters, to my mind, things like character and prayer are at the heart of apologetics and evangelism. You know, the two go hand in hand nowadays, and that's something we really need to start getting across to young people.
You know, I wanted to bring it full circle with that very idea. That's exactly what I had in mind. How important apologetics is as the handmaiden to evangelism, God using your well-reasoned answer as a springboard or an opportunity to share the truth, the joy, the love, the peace, the experience you can have with the living God.
Yes, like I said, I mean, people have sometimes said, I mean, you get this response in the evangelical churches, particularly from those of a more Calvinistic bent, you know, the only person who can, you know, why bother with apologetics? The only person who can call someone to faith is God. And my answer to that is, listen, have you looked at how many times in Scripture God reasons with unbelievers, where he sets out evidence in his Gospels and in the book of Acts, where he challenges the foolishness of unbelief? If you're going to communicate God's word effectively to unbelievers, you've got to take apologetics seriously. You have got to sit down and you've got to look at, how can I reason with an unbeliever? Because that's what God does. He reasons with unbelievers. And yes, he commands and he calls and he persuades and he does all those things, but reasoning is in there too. And we can't ignore that. And so apologetics, you know, just a reasoned defense for the faith that's within you, is at the very heart of what we do. And the other side of apologetics is that it brings the Christian faith to life in surprising ways. I talked earlier about the moral argument and the design argument. If you're taking those arguments seriously, you've got to sit down and say, you know, the God I worshipped is responsible for the design and structure of the universe. How great is that God? The God I worship is the source of all moral authority. So when I read his word, I have to take that seriously. Whenever I consider who he is and I worship him, this is who I'm worshiping, the source of all beauty, the source of all goodness. And I would certainly want to push the moral argument beyond just, you know, moral obligations. I would say that God's the source of all goodness. So when you start to really get to grips with apologetics and use that in your evangelism, it actually strengthens the Christian life. It's not an add-on to the Christian faith. It's not a little bit that we do extra. It's not something for, you know, a small sub-branch of evangelists. It's really about communicating the Christian faith faithfully to a world which is hostile to it. And you've got to communicate to this hostile world in a way that they can understand, and in a way that challenges it, and in a way that reasons with it, and is in a way that is faithful to the way that God speaks to unbelief in his word. So I would argue that apologetics actually should bring you closer to God in your Christian life. It is not just a dry academic exercise. It is anything but. It is something that is vitally important to me as a Christian, and I think needs to be considered to be vitally important to the church. And you know, going back to church history, it's been vitally important to the church fathers, vitally important to Wesley, vitally important to so many key characters in church history, that to somehow void this out of our Christian life is a terrible mistake.
That is just beautifully said. And I am so delighted that I ran across you as a result of your book, New Atheism, A Survival Guide. Graham, you have really blessed everybody listening in. And again, I'm very grateful for the work that you do and for communicating in an interesting way and reaching a whole new level, a whole new stratum of millennials that may otherwise never encounter these arguments or engage them. So thank you. It's just great to know you.
Thank you very much, Hank. It's been very, very good talking to you. It's been a very real blessing.
Well, bless you, Graham, and hope you get through the snowstorm.
I'm sure we'll survive. I'm maybe get a snow day tomorrow if I'm lucky.
Yeah,
at least
6
centimeters here, so you don't know my luck.
Of course. Well, good talking to you, and thanks again for your contribution to the Hank Unplugged podcast.
Well, we've run out of time for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. To listen to this Hank Unplugged podcast interview with Christian apologist Graham Veal in its entirety, go to equip.org, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Followers of the Lord Jesus in our time are exposed to relentless attacks on theism by atheists. Graham Veal's concise book, New Atheism, A Survival Guide, will help you understand atheism and how best to respond to the threat it poses. In appreciation for your gift to help strengthen and expand the mind-shaping ministries of the Christian Research Institute, Hank Hanegraaff would like to send you a copy of New Atheism, A Survival Guide. Just call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271, or simply visit online at equip.org. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter. Of Nancy Piercy's recent book, Love Thy Body, Answering Hard Questions About Life and Sexuality, Professor Robert P. George of Princeton University says, liberal secularist ideology rests on a mistake, and Nancy Piercy puts her finger right on it. In embracing abortion, euthanasia, homosexual conduct and relationships, transgenderism and the like, liberal secularism is philosophically as well as theologically untenable. Piercy is precisely clear about what makes humans valuable. Don't just read, master Love Thy Body. To receive your hardcover copy as our appreciation for your financial partnership, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-transforming outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Richard Dawkins' grasp of philosophical arguments wouldn't earn him a passing grade in a freshman philosophy course, but he doesn't mean to deal with the questions that theists are asking. He simply ridicules his opponent's position. In New Atheism, A Survival Guide, Graham Veal explains, the new atheist stance is that the reasons for theism must be so bad, why even read about them? My goodness, no, you just dismiss them. Veal goes on to show that the new atheists have not offered one original argument for atheism, but they've plenty of original insults. New Atheism offers an accessible, practical resource for countering new atheist attacks. To receive your copy of New Atheism, A Survival Guide, as our thank you gift, simply call 888-7000-CRI. And make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, or visit equip.org.